This is John Montagna. Welcome to Breaking It Down with Jeff and John, a music podcast for Culture Sonar. Today, my partner Jeff Ganz and I are celebrating the artistry of an iconic American musician, legendary drummer Steve Gadd. And now your hosts, Jeff Ganz and John Montagna. All right, we're back. Welcome to Breaking It Down with Jeff and John. I'm John Montagna.
I'm Jeff Ganz. How are y'all doing?
This show is going to be devoted to someone who I think, and I know I'm not alone in this assessment, I don't want to say one of the greatest drummers ever, because I know you and I both have this thing about he's not a drummer. He's a musician who plays the
exactly.
drums. Exactly. Right?
Exactly. That's been one of my favorite expressions to describe somebody that they just are so musical, like, you know, superb musicians to play whatever instrument they play.
And we like guys like that. And we seek out guys like that. Steve Gadd.
No doubt.
And one of those names that for certain people, you drop that name and they go, yeah. And if you don't know,
then you should.
And that's why we're here.
And we're also here, you know, as much as what is known and what everybody knows about him, we're actually going to be presenting some things that some people at large may not know about to substantiate, you know, our feelings about Steve Gadd.
Exactly. As bass players. And
speaking of as bass players, yeah. One of the things that we decided to do this time is that we have gone to a panel of experts that are drummers, and not just drummers, also superb, fully formed musicians to play the drums,
right.
and that have a particular affinity with Steve Gadd on a musical and personal level.
That's right. Because, you know, when Jeff and I were planning this out, we knew right away we're going to need to bring drummers into this conversation. So I've been having phone conversations with a handful of hand-picked drummers who, like you said, had some affinity for him, for Gadd, either
which are analogous
or
to how Gadd started out, because Gadd was not the kind of musician that was being heavily publicized as a drum athlete.
Right.
I mean, he was a guy that traveled in the freelance circles.
Right.
And became known to people because of his superb work.
You know, you bring that up about being known as a drum athlete. I don't know that he was traveling in any specific circle. And we'll get into my conversation with Jim Saporito, who brings that up, you know, his background a little bit
more. One of the best musicians you'll ever run into. He's one of those rare breeds of fully formed percussionist.
Yes.
But can also sit down and play drums and be a real drummer. I've played with him as a drummer a lot, and I've also worked with him as a percussionist.
Yes.
Let me tell you that when you sit down and play groove with Saporito playing drums, it's a lot of fun.
I believe you. And this is something that we're going to get into with him. But let's talk about our conversation that we're going to have now, you and I, Jeff.
Okay.
I want to know,
in the moment,
your first awareness of Steve Gadd, because for me, he was just always around. Me being the age that I was, the pop records that were on the radio in the 70s, probably a good half of them had Steve Gadd on drums, and I didn't even know it.
Okay, but there's this a lot of the stuff, you know, you just made me realize, I sort of felt the same way as you, that okay. he was always around.
Yeah.
But then when somebody said, you got to hear this,
yep.
and it was Chucky's In Love by Ricky Lee Jones
uh-huh.
with that little fill.
No, it don't come here no more.
Yep.
And then I started attaching a name to this greatness. And of course, like everybody else, you want to investigate the rest of it.
Sure.
And there was a whole lot of rest of it to investigate. Best known to the public probably is 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, which we're actually not going to talk about that much here because everybody else has discussed it.
Saporito and I talked about it briefly, but
what did he have to say about it?
I'll let him tell you.
Fine with me.
When we drop in his conversation.
Talk to me, Sap.
Jeff tells me that you have a connection to Steve Gadd in the sense that you went to Eastman?
Correct.
Okay. Give me a taste of what the Eastman School of Music
is all about, what there, if there's like a philosophy there or an ethos there. Tell me a little bit about that musical ecosystem up there.
Well, when I went to school, I was there from 73 to 77. So in Rochester, you still had nightclubs and major people would come through town. It was starting to ebb a little, but living in the town were some of the best jazz players around, like Joe Romano and Vinnie Ruggiero and Ronnie Davis, the late drummer, was there. Joe LaBarbera. Gad grew up there. The Mangionis were from there, Jerry Nywood. And so there was a high level of playing all around town. Matter of fact, when I came to New York in 79, I was working at the Music Hall. That's where I met Jeff Gans. You know, I'd go out to hear some jazz players that guys in town were raving about. They couldn't carry the reeds of some of the saxophone players I played with in upstate New York.
Wow, okay.
The upstate thing is all about time and rhythm.
Got it.
And the groove is very deep, and the playing in those days is at a very high level, and that's what was expected. The Salzano brothers were up there, Benny and his brother, Joey Corazzato, Joe Locke of Jazz Vitus is from Rochester. He played with Vinnie Ruggiero's group.
Got it.
At Eastman, Mr. Beck was our teacher, and he was Steve Gadd's teacher. And it's all about time, rhythm, and feel. Everything we did on snare drum was all about that.
Okay.
Everyone I went to school with had really good time.
Did you encounter Justin DiCiocio at all?
He was my teacher here in high school when I grew up. Justin's one of my best friends.
Got
I started studying with Justin in 1971.
Okay. I was a student of his at LaGuardia from 1986 to 1990.
He introduced me when the Friends in Love album came out by Chuck Mangione.
Yeah.
Steve Gadd had just gotten out in the Army, and he's playing on that.
Right.
And he played it for me at his house. And what I noticed was, this is the first time I heard drums the way they're supposed to sound.
Okay.
And that's how the feel's supposed to be. It's everything I knew was right about it. And that's what I started emulating at that age.
Okay.
Steve Gadd's playing was the clearest example of simplicity of time and feel that always felt good.
Got it.
And there are no extraneous notes, ever.
Right.
There's no cymbal sound ringing over. There's no noise in his playing. Never has been.
That's right.
From the time he was more choppier as a younger player to now. There are a lot of drummers, there's a lot of noise.
Sure.
But Steve's playing has more of a focus, and it's at a deeper level of feel. So he doesn't need the noise to fill in. And if you can really play the instrument, I tell my students this, all you need is a bass drum, snare drum, hi-hat, and a cymbal.
Right.
Anyone who can really play the instrument can play any gig with that. You don't need toms. You don't need hugging a bugger with the toms and the bass drum. You don't need any of that shit. All you need is know how to play time with a deep beat.
Yeah.
If you know how to do that, you can play any job with a snare drum, hi-hat, and a bass drum. You don't even need a crash cymbal or a ride cymbal if you can really play.
Yep.
So I think Steve has a deep understanding of that, since one of his idols was Gene Krupa. And Gene Krupa came up the same way, with a big, deep swing and beat, just playing those three parts of the kit.
Right. He does seem to leave a lot of space. He'll do things where he's just maybe beating out quarters or eighths and letting all the subdivision come from somewhere else, but he's not cluttering up the picture.
Well, that's the secret, and that's what makes the music come alive, is the air. You know,
right.
Less is more. If you got a band that can play time the way Stuff did, with a piano player like that and a rhythm guitar player like Eric Gale,
sure,
you don't have to play anything.
Yeah,
because they got it so covered. All you do is add the point to the note, the downbeat and the backbeat, in a very relaxed way, and you're done. He's the epitome of that. Now, I thought of someone, you said Eastman Rochester. Eastman, unlike most music schools, we had the greatest wind ensemble in the world. And the original conductor was Fred Fennell, who was a percussion major at Eastman. He had great time.
Right.
So there was a tradition in the school with the wind ensembles recording marches and wind band music. If you listen to those records, you can set your watch to them.
Yeah.
So there's that tradition, too.
Okay.
You know, it's about time and rhythm, that school. I mean, even the Blues Brothers band with my friend Lou Marini and all that stuff. You listen very carefully to those horns. The time is ridiculous.
That's right.
They're so locked into the pocket.
Mm.
You know, Jerry Nywood, may he rest in peace, made a record with Vinnie Ruggiero. Just the two of them. Just saxophone and drums. They were jam sessions that Jerry taped. The stuff is on fire. You don't miss the bass and you don't miss the piano. Steve Gadd knew Vinnie Ruggiero very, very well.
Okay.
Vinnie was one of the greatest swingiest drummers I ever heard. Unbelievable. And, you know, and Tony Levin will tell you that. Steve Gadd will tell you that.
Right.
So the level of playing was so high. And he grew up in a nurturing environment, Steve did. With his parents, his uncle was a drummer.
Right,
going
right.
out to sit in, to play with Dizzy Gillespie and Chuck, and that from the time he's in high school, he's playing at a very high level, playing with people better than him.
Sure.
That are kind of bringing him along, and he's got a lot to practice because he's inspired. You know, he was working six nights a week with Tony Levin and Gap when he's going to school. Now, if you want to learn how to play, that's what you need to do.
Right.
Most kids today don't have those opportunities. They're not there. Yeah, you have to make them. You have to have that kind of thing. You always got to jam and play.
The interplay.
Well, he's been doing that his whole career. He still sits in on his time off in clubs out in Phoenix. He'll go out and there'll be a band playing. That's okay. He'll walk up the bandstand. Of course, everyone recognizes. Can I play? Now, why would he do that? Even if they're not as good as him. You do that to challenge yourself to adjust to a situation immediately. It's what keeps your playing sharp.
Right.
It's the same thing a comedian does when they go to Caroline's or a comedy club to work out. You need to have that interaction with musicians because you can have the best gig in the world like James Taylor and all these gigs. He makes all kinds of bread. Right. But he knows deep down that's not playing.
Right.
He's playing a show with those guys. With Paul Simon, you're playing a show. Playing is when you go and sit in someplace or you rehearse with a band of your own choice and you're stretching out your musical intentions and learning about yourself.
And you're discovering things and you're required to pay attention to your surroundings.
Correct. And that's how you improve your playing. That's why these guys always love to record. That's why I always love to record.
Right.
It's because I'm playing with different people every day and there's a playback. I can hear how I'm interacting.
Yeah.
Does it sound right? Is he ahead? Am I behind? How can I make this work better? Yeah. That is fine-tuning your musicianship. And that's what he's always done. And you got to remember something else what makes him unique.
Yeah.
Like the old great drummers like Joe Jones, Louis Belson, and Buddy Rich and all those guys. They're all really good tap dancers.
Really?
Really good tap dancers.
I mean, I'm surprised, but I'm not at the same time. Like, that makes
they're all
sense.
Really good. I got films of Buddy tapping that is as good as Fred Astaire.
That's
I have one where Louis Belson, it's on YouTube. He and Steve do a duet, and they go to the edge of the stage, and they do a little step together.
That's crazy.
No, it's not.
But I mean,
drummers and the musicians in the old days, even the trumpet players, like Snooky Young on The Tonight Show, great tap dancers.
Interesting.
It's part of the tradition of being an entertainer minstrel coming out of the Second World War, before the World War, when they were kids. If you had an act, you had a dance, too. So you have to understand about Steve Gadd is that he comes from a very deep tradition. He's a great dancer, and he still dances, and you can see all these videos on YouTube.
Well, you can also, you know, you'd watch the way he moves behind the kit. Like every era.
Well, he sits like a dancer.
Whether it's with stuff in the 70s or like some of the more recent stuff with James Taylor or whoever, the way he moves behind the kit, you can tell that he's got an awareness of how the music moves your body.
Well, he understands his physicality.
Yeah.
The stool is set at the right height. He's got short legs, so he knows he sits low.
Okay.
But his back is straight, just like a tap dancer.
Interesting.
His knees are bent. Just like a tap dance.
Do you think that this is what has sort of ensured his success as a session musician all those years?
Technique is not what makes you a good session musician.
Got it.
Creativity, though.
Right.
But I think what you're getting at is what Steve's technique has not ensured him as a session player. It's just ensured that his connection with his feet and hands and body are intact.
Right.
Because you play the drums from the feet up. You don't play the drums from the hands down.
Uh-huh.
You play from the feet up. And if you're a tap dancer, that means you have great control of your feet and legs. So all you have to do is lock in the thought in your head and the pulse in your heart, and it's in your legs, and the hands just follow along.
Right.
And he is the exemplar of that more than anyone, where his feet are so strong in their solid foundation. I know that's redundant, but
right.
the pulse is so deep down there. He's it makes everything that much easier for him.
Right.
Now, Steve, I've watched very carefully since I was 19. I saw him. He used to come go visit his parents in Rochester. Mr. Beck would have him come by the school. And he'd come by and sit at a set of drums and just play. And you could watch him from the back, the front, and it's all down below. His hands were doing all kinds. The sounds were great. He never banged. No noise.
Right.
Every beat made sense.
No noise.
But what the feet were doing and the sound he got out of the bass drum and hi-hat, completely unique. No one else gets that sound with a hi-hat like he does.
Mm-hmm.
He really knows how to make those cymbals chick. And he also knows how to make them crush and get that really breathy, like, shh sound.
Uh-huh.
And he's unique for that, too. Other guys try it, but they don't do it like he does.
Right.
So that's what I can say about him. And a great rudimental snare drummer.
Yes. I'm sure 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover is going to come up in the conversation.
Well, that's an off-field cadence. That's just the marching off-field cadence when the drum... If you ever went to the old drum and bugle corps back in the 60s or any of the things.
No.
But after they do their show, they would march off the field to a very quiet cadence. When the corps is marching quietly off the field for the next corps to come on.
Got it.
First time I heard it, I knew it was him playing. I was in college.
Okay.
And I listened to it. I said, well, that's Steve.
Yep.
And I said, that's an off-field cadence that I used to hear at the competitions when I was a little kid.
Wow.
Very creative, you know, and he's used all his tools, all his experiences feed to the other. He's very open-minded.
Right.
Do you have the Alive album of Chuck Mangione's?
No.
Okay, buy it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll tell you why, John. These are the greatest Steve Gadd solos in history. This is 1972.
Got it. Okay.
It was for like flood relief in Rochester or something. Chuck did a concert. Justin was there.
Okay.
This is the finest playing he ever did. They do High Heel Sneaker, Legend of the One-Eyed Sailor, which starts with a drum solo called Crazy Army.
Okay.
It's standard in the Army's rudiment book. And Steve learned it because he was in the Army.
Right.
Check this out. It's a little bebop set of Gretsch drums, two cymbals. That's it.
Wow.
Tony Levin on bass, Chuck and Jerry Nywer. Check out the drum set playing.
Okay.
If you've never heard this, you've never really heard all of Steve Gadd's playing, because this is some of the greatest playing he ever did.
Alive?
It's when he's a young player with lots of chops playing a lot of notes.
Right.
But there's still, there's no noise.
Nice. Okay.
There's no noise. Everything makes sense. You know?
Great. Alive is the name of the album?
Yeah, it's on Mercury. Put on Legend of the One-Eyed Sailor and listen to the snare drum and bass drum and just like what he's playing. You'll be like, oh my God.
Okay.
You'll hear things you've never heard before.
I've got a few favorite Gadd things myself. They may or may not be known, you know, to the populace at large, but I've heard them. I like them. I appreciated them for all different reasons.
Yeah,
and fortunately, we're able to exemplify some of them here.
What's interesting is you've got a song like 50 Ways or Chucky's in Love. These were mainstream pop radio hits.
Yes, they were.
Right. And his ability to sort of travel in the mainstream pop, I mean, look, Paul Simon, James Taylor, Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, the top of the mainstream pop game by anyone's standards. Yet he's also traveling in this jazz circle with Chick Corea, Chuck Mangione.
Yes, yes. And here's an interesting aside.
Yeah.
I was watching Robert Trujillo's Jocko movie.
Okay.
A very well-respected piece of work.
Yes.
But the reason I'm bringing it up is that it was mentioned at the time when Jaco was doing his word of mouth project, there were budgets for jazz.
Right.
And people were putting money in to records that you're describing,
mm-hmm.
the Chick Corea records,
yeah.
the Michelle Petrucciani records. I mean, they were actual, you know, sources of revenue for people that the record companies were investing
in. I wonder if that is somehow connected to the fact that there was so much crosstalk. The people that were playing on the Al Jarreau albums were also playing on the Chick Corea albums and Weather Report, and guys were going back and forth between those kinds
Without
of sessions.
Without a doubt. They just weren't as well publicized.
Right. But here's the other thing. You listen to those pop records. I mean, I listened to Al Jarreau Breaking Away on the way out here, and I'm listening to the keyboard solo on Easy, and I'm like, if that's not a jazz-influenced thing... The vocabulary of jazz, there's harmonic things and rhythmic things and melodic things making their way in from jazz into pop. And there was
Steely Dan is the best example of all of this, I think.
Thank you. The track you played me is a thing from Michelle Petrucciani.
With Anthony Jackson on bass.
Okay.
And a live concert in Stuttgart.
I read an Anthony Jackson interview years ago where he described the resistance that he and Gad faced from the jazz press, that why is Michelle Petrucciani using session players in his trio? And I would say the clip that you played me answers that question.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, you're also dealing with a much bigger concept that has to be investigated,
which is
pigeonholing.
Thank you.
Just because you hear a musician in one context doesn't matter, facilitate that they could do other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
That's the perfect segue kind of into Stuff.
Yep. I will admit that I didn't get Stuff until when Stuff first came out. I didn't get it the way I get it now.
Of course.
You know, the better I get at what I do, the more I appreciate something.
Exactly.
It's like,
right.
What rock have I been hiding under?
You hear that phrase, the comedian's comedian, or the musician's musician. Like, this is the band that the other musicians listen to.
Right.
And for those not familiar, Stuff is led by a bassist named Gordon Edwards.
Yep.
Richard T on keyboards, Eric Gale and Cornell Dupree.
Correct.
On guitars, and the often twin drum attack of Steve Gadd and Chris Parker.
A completely different Chris drummer. Parker. And I've been fortunate to have worked with Chris a bunch of times.
Yep.
And he's great, but great comes in a lot of forms. I mean, you're talking about Steve Gadd and Chris Parker, it's like, well, would you like steak or would you like lobster?
Right.
But
or would
different.
You like surf and turf?
Exactly.
You know what? Pause this podcast, go to Amazon and order a DVD of Stuff Live at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1976,
yes.
Which rolls out the red carpet for the clip that Jeff and I both agree is the shit. Now, that solo goes on a lot longer than that, and I'm not going to play the clip. I want you to purchase the DVD.
Yes.
That solo blew me away for a number of reasons. You know, obviously, it's an incredible display of musicianship, but what I love about it is that he eventually builds on that motif around the drums, and then he starts like this samba groove that includes the cowbell,
right, which has become a Steve Gadd signature.
Correct. And then he starts bringing the dynamics down and down and down, and it fades out, and I've never seen a drum solo that doesn't get build and louder and louder and louder,
especially
like a fireworks display for a guy to start a drum solo at 100 and then gradually bring it down and down and down.
Right.
Until but it what fades away. Needs, like, what an amazing concept.
Right. But also what needs to be noted here is because the drums are so close mic'd.
Right.
To be able to do that is not easy.
You're not wrong, but it's not about the drums being mic'd. It's about the musicianship.
No, I'm saying that the musicianship is more extreme, that because you're able to change the dynamics of something that, like, you're basically putting your ear up to rack tom one. You're
right.
Basically putting your ear up to the bass drum. Mm-hmm. And to be able to pull off dynamics like that, drum miking is not in your favor, is my point.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Because even if you hit a bass drum lightly, it still can sound like a cannon.
Well, to the point about using the rental kit and using whatever's in front of you, I'm going to relay a story that a fine, fine drummer named Jonathan Mover told me. In addition to being an amazing drummer.
Yeah, we've worked together. He is great.
Yeah, Mover also ran a recording studio for many years, Skyline.
And, right.
So Mover told me a story about hiring Gad for a session. Probably in the 80s or 90s. By this time, Gad is already, he's already Gad. You know, he's already one of those guys. And he's thinking, man, I'm going to have the great Steve Gadd in my studio. It was like a big date. I think it was like, it might have been a big band session, bunch of horns. It's a large band. It's a large session. It's not just like a rhythm section date. And he sits down behind the kit, doesn't adjust the stool, doesn't adjust the drums, doesn't do anything to the kit at all. Doesn't make any changes to it. Just sits down, picks up the sticks that are there. Now you know how this story is going to end.
Of course.
Right? But I'll tell it anyway. Okay, let's do one. Okay, rolling. Bang. Nails the chart perfectly. First take. That was great. Let's try another one just as a safety. Take two. Bang. Nails it even more perfectly. And this is a story that I've heard over and over again from multiple sources where Gad walks in and goes, okay, got it. In one take, he's completely
inside it.
Thank you. And now, apropos of nothing, I want to go to a conversation I had with Steve Murphy, who I feel like somehow inadequate introducing the guy.
Again, another fully formed musician who's a great drummer. I mean, I get to play with him all the time, as do you.
Yes.
Steve and I work in the Hitmen together.
He and I toured the world and elsewhere with Alan Parsons. Happy Together, Hippie Fest. I've been in a million different situations with him musically and otherwise. You talk about brother from another mother.
So check out what he had to say.
You know, I was introduced to him on the Asia album, probably, I would assume. Like he said, it just felt like he was always there. But I was skipping the class after lunch in senior year of high school.
Yeah.
So this is 83.
Yeah.
And my surf buddy had a 68, 69 Corvair convertible. We'd take that to lunch, and he had the classic Jensen triaxials in the back seat in the boxes.
Yeah.
One on either side, you know, and had his power amp and his 5-band EQ. And it was cassettes, man. It was 83, so it was still just cassettes.
Sure, sure.
And he had Demiola Electric Rendezvous.
Ah, okay.
And he goes, dude, check this out. And, you know, illegal things accompanied it on the way.
Yeah,
you know,
right, sure.
We were going.
You well,
know,
you were in the car, so you had to.
Exactly. Pick up a 6-pack because we got to hear this whole album.
Right.
And, man, sitting between those two oval triaxial speakers and listening to that record. Yeah. My God. You know, and the stops and starts of the, you know, the quick little 1 to 2 measure solos on that record on the first cut, I think it is, or on the second cut. Just unbelievable, you know, just this, you know, you can tell it's totally off the cuff. It just blows my mind how there could be like a hesitation, a stop and a restart through the same fill, if you know what I'm saying, and it not sound clumsy.
Constant awareness of where the groove is, where the pocket is.
Exactly. But he can break it up.
Right.
And he was breaking it up on a subconscious level and going, I'm going to restart 2/16th note, you know, 16th note or a dotted 16th later, and it's not going to sound jagged. It's going to sound, you know, smooth. I would say that's my favorite Gad performance.
Okay.
Is on yeah. that record.
Guy just always lands on his feet. There are so many examples of that, of him taking a solo and leaving these huge spaces where you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And boom, it lands right back
that's
on
exactly
where
it.
It's got to be.
That's the perfect example of that. Oh, wait, I forgot to tell you that there was an encounter I didn't tell you about.
Oh, tell me about the encounter.
Okay, so there's an encounter. There's an incident. More of an incident More than an encounter. Really. So, 88, I'm working. Well, it was 87 to 88, but I'm guessing it was 88 towards the end of my tenure at SIR Studios in New York. And I was a rehearsal tech there, and it was craziness. Although, I mean, I sat behind Phil Collins' drums one day. It was like died and go to heaven kind of gig for me.
Right.
On a day in 88, Studio 2, which was one of their smaller rooms, had Steve Gadd set up with Richard T. and Ron Carter.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, my jaw was wide open all day with them there. And I stopped Steve as he was on his way into the big room. And I had to say, just, you know, a huge fan, and just got to, you know, got to say, I know it's typical to say it, but Asia, it just blows my mind. And, you know, was it really one take?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, it's pretty much one take. I mean, he just confirmed it. I mean, he said it so nonchalantly. It was like, yeah, but I mean, he was nice enough, but he was on his way into the other room. He said, yeah, pretty much. But I got to go. So,
right.
You know, I was one of those guys. One of those guys
asking him if Asia was one take.
Exactly. And so at least he's got me on the list of one of those guys that had to ask him. And you know, it was only, 11 years after. It wasn't that long after. So it hadn't even completely matured.
Right.
to the music world yet.
It's like a peak moment in the song that happens sort of early on, right? Because there's like another verse that follows it, another verse and chorus that follows
it. That arrangement is insane. And so, so you have the first passage of soloing and you're like, really? And then there's another verse. So it's a precursor to check this shit out.
Right. You know? So the outro.
Exactly. That fade out of that. He is just pushing the accelerator as it goes into the samba, goes into the Latin.
Right. I was going to say the samba thing. Yeah. That takes, that takes brass balls to like, well, what else can I do? Like go into like a ridiculous samba groove.
Push the tempo and make everybody play more on their toes.
During
have everybody
fade.
Just, yeah. So yeah, that proves it right there.
I want to relate one story from one of a very close friend of mine named David Katzenberg, a great bass player, and he has a great Steve Gadd story.
Bring it on.
And the story is he's doing a jingle in the 80s. Steve Gadd is the drummer. And I called Dave the other night. And I said, so what was it like working with Steve Gadd? And the first thing he said was, he made me sound brilliant.
You don't even need to say anything else.
And that basically has a lot to do with taking yourself out of the picture and making it not be about you.
Make it about the music.
Make it about something else, which is why these people we're describing ended up being where they are.
Right.
You're listening to Breaking It Down with Jeff and John, a music podcast for Culture Sonar. Today, we're celebrating the musical artistry of drum legend Steve Gadd.
Let me chime in about Ray Marchica.
Please do.
There are not too many drummers you can mention that have played with Barbra Streisand, Ed Palermo, Dan Hartman.
Yeah.
And
Roy Buchanan.
And Roy Buchanan, exactly. And loves jazz. He's done some great jazz records of his own. They're called In the Ring and A Different View, and they're must hears.
Edit points.
Thank you for thank you for starting that.
Around 1976, when I graduated college, I kept hearing about Steve Gadd. And then the first real record was Chick Corea, Leprechaun.
Tell me about Leprechaun. What was it?
So Leprechaun was the one that, there was one tune on it called Lenore.
Okay.
He's a rudimental drummer. So you play patterns like right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left, or double paradiddles, or rhythm cues, And he's able to implement it so musically, the drum set, and not sound like some marching band drummer playing jazz.
Right. So, even though he's like steeped in that tradition,
yeah,
he sort of maintains it as like a through line.
Exactly.
It's still within the context of whatever he's doing.
He made it so musical sounding.
Right.
So Lenore, he started the groove on the floor tom. I remember transcribing that, and it just flowed with Chick's line.
Right.
And plus the sound of the drums, they were just like perfect sounding studio drums.
Right. that was sort of like the beginning of that as well. Like miking each drum individually and the drums being tuned and sounding a certain way, as opposed to like jazz kits that were like mic'd, you know, with like one or two mics over the whole kit. Now you're getting into the studio era where each individual drum's being mic'd.
Yeah. And his drums were slightly smaller. He came up with most guys used to use a 12-inch tom, the smallest tom, and he was the first guy to really use a double-headed, two heads on a 10-inch tom. So it's a smaller drum. He can tune it a little lower, like he tuned it in the same range as a 12-inch drum, but he'd be able to hit it harder, and it would sound bigger, it was smaller.
Okay.
And then guys started using 10-inch toms, and now that's the standard.
Right.
And then at the same time, he's playing with stuff. That's how I got to see him live, playing more R&B. And so here's this guy who's like playing complicated, amazing patterns with Chick Corea. And then I'd be able to go watch him play, you know, R&B grooves with stuff.
Where did you used to see them? At like Mikkel's and places like that?
Mikkel's.
Okay.
Yeah, Mikkel's. Then I used to see him at the Bottom Line. I saw him with Tom Scott. Around the same time, 1976, 77, I'm out of college. I'm subbing Broadway. Then he's on all these CTI records, like, and the two records that stood out for me were Chet Baker, She Was Too Good For Me, I think was the name of the album.
Okay.
And then a Hubert Laws record, Gergen. It's just flute and drums. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Check it out. You just hear the brilliance, the precision, the musicality, the tone of the drums. And they probably did that in one take.
Yeah, you know? Right.
So he used to play hard. He used to really play harder. Now, like if you listen to a good example now is the Chick Corea, Steve Gadd record called Chinese Butterfly. It came out about 6 months ago.
Oh, okay.
This is a great example of how he's still so brilliant, but his drums are more of a jazzy sound. They ring out more. He doesn't hit as hard. He's older now. He's 72.
Right, right.
But it's still brilliant. It's just like, oh my God.
Did you ever go through like a Steve Gadd period where you were like consciously emulating him? I mean, because I like a lot of bass players tend to go through like a Jaco period. For guitar players, they go through.
Yeah, I got myself in trouble when I was like 25 years old. When he said, I was like, who's Ray Marchica now? Because I'm trying to be Steve Gadd.
You know?
But I was young. I was like 24, 25.
Sure.
And I just got to say something about him.
Please.
Okay. So, say 8, 9 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, he was playing at the Blue Note. He recognized my face, and they had just finished a set.
Now, let's back up a little bit. First of all, who was he playing with?
I think he was with Joe Sample that night.
Okay.
Joe Sample. So he said, hey, man, how you doing? And I think he recognized me because I used to watch him a lot, and I was the drummer on the Rosie O'Donnell show, and I think he knew.
Okay.
Kind of knew my face. You know? He said, hey, man, how you doing? He said, how's your family? Right? That's what he said. How's your family?
Yeah.
And at that time, my stepdaughter was being treated for cancer.
Oh, wow.
And she's fine now. She's free and clear.
Excellent.
For 12 years.
Glad to hear it.
And the minute I said that, he turned around, looked at me, ignored everyone else around him. She said, man, tell me about what's, you know, he really wanted to hear about my family and how my daughter was. And he said, oh, man. And he gave me his phone number. He said, call me, man. And actually, he gave me a lift home that night because he wanted to hear my story.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So that's how nice he is. He's so humble and nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's amazing, man.
He's brilliant. He's a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
He is.
Yeah.
And he doesn't cop to it. You know, he doesn't cop to it.
I mean, I guess that's part of what makes him what he is, right? I mean, he's always in service to the music. It's not about like, hey, look at me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. Oh, his playing with the group Steps, Mike Canary.
Right.
Oh, my God. That's another one. Smoking in the Pit.
Okay.
If you listen to Teabag, T-E-E-B-A-G.
Right. Him and Richard T.
Talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go to a clip of Steve Gadd at the first Buddy Rich. Was it the Memorial
Concert?
It was
one of the very first Buddy Rich Memorial Concerts.
Was that the scholarship thing?
Probably one of the earlier ones. Yeah, Kathy, you know, Buddy's daughter was putting it on.
I should know this because
80s and 90s.
A dear friend of mine, Tobias Ralph, was... I believe, if not the first, he was one of the first winners of the Buddy Rich Memorial Scholarship.
And you could check out Tobias Ralph with Adrian Ballou, boys and girls.
That's right. So let's go to the clip of Steve Gadd's solo on what's
Well,
the
it's
song
not
called?
Really the solo. It's the chart is Keep the Customer Satisfied.
Okay.
And the thing to note about all of this is while everybody else feels that they need to play busy a la Buddy, Steve Gadd was just laying down the most fierce time. And when it came time to solo, was soloing like a musician.
Check it out. Pivoting to something completely different, I'm going to talk about my favorite Gadd stuff, his work with Paul McCartney on what I would consider to be one of the best solo Beatles albums, Tug of War.
Well, I'll fess up. I didn't know anything about it until you presented it to me, and now I'm a convert. So thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thanks for opening up my ears again.
It's my pleasure. Know? Track 2, Take It Away. It was a single, don't know what the chart position was, that's for somebody else to figure out, but there was a video, it was a fairly substantial hit. It's Ringo and Steve Gadd together.
Take it away, wanna hear you play till the lights go down.
You played me this thing 10 minutes ago. It's like, what?
I mean, it's like sitting in a beanbag chair and somebody handing you a cold drink on a hot day. Like, oh, my God.
And again, you know, it's the way you pointed it out to me, the fact that the things are hard panned like that.
Yeah.
And then you said to me, you know, I won the challenge, which you said, which one is which?
Yep.
And I got it right.
You knew right away.
And, you know, just that another Steve Gadd testament is that he walks in, assesses the situation quickly and does what needs to be done with no BS.
You know, I'm always thinking like a producer while we're doing this thing. Like, well, we're really talking about a lot of other players here, but
that has a lot to do with it too.
I think that kind of proves the point. The fact that somebody like Steve Gadd, who's an icon, has got all these tentacles that have spread out into all these different kinds of drummers.
Honorable mention, Dave Weckl.
Yep.
Who has taken what Steve Gadd started and developed into Dave Weckl.
Absolutely.
And I've played with him, and he is that good.
Absolutely.
And I've seen the clip of Weckl, Vinnie Colaiuta, and Steve Gadd playing together at one of those Buddy concerts. And you're really dealing with three different types of drummers. But but Dave Weckl evolved, you know, I mean, that's what we're all trying to do, is evolve into the best us we can.
That's right. Apropos of nothing, I want to drop in my conversation with another tremendous drummer, Steve Singer.
And the other thing to note about Steve Singer is that he has a relationship with Steve Gadd because Steve Singer is a professional and excellent photographer and has photographed Steve Gadd. His work's been featured in many periodicals, newspapers, and on record covers.
Let's talk about that.
Be ready for love.
It's tell me about this photo that you took.
Well, I met Mika Yoshida. She was telling me what she was going to do with Steve Gadd. We started talking about Steve Gadd, of course. And then she said she was going to work with him and have a rehearsal. And I said, well, you know, I'd love to meet him sometimes. I would do some photographs for you. I would do it for nothing if I could meet Steve Gadd. So I got to meet him, and it was at Bob Ayer's old studio. It was Steve Gadd, Eddie Gomez, a keyboard player, a young guy I didn't know. Mika was playing jazz marimba, and Steve was producing the record. They did rehearsal, and I had total access to it, and it was great.
Because Jeff was saying to me that you're like a legit photographer as well, so it wasn't like you were just a fanboy.
Well, no. Like I say, I was a photo major, and I do that for people as well.
Okay, so you were able to separate the drummer and the Steve Gadd fan in that moment.
Well, I don't know about that.
Okay.
I mean, it was unbelievable. But on the break, I mean, we just sat and talked, and I told him about the kind of things that I do, a lot of Broadway things. And like everyone says, he was just the nicest guy in the world. And he was interested in me, you know, in what I was doing, you know, that kind of thing. So,
right.
Cool.
Was there a specific album or a tune or an artist he was working with where he first caught your attention?
There was a Bonnie Raitt album called Streetlights. And it was like Bonnie Raitt gets the New York treatment.
Uh-huh.
Like David Spinoza, it was like Bonnie Raitt doing a funk album,
right?
And it was just so great, and I loved it. And I hear this drummer, and he's laying down this great funk beat, and he's doing rolls as like half notes and whole notes, or somebody might open a hi hat, you know, and go, you know, opening the hi hat, but instead he's doing like a real, really super clean 5 or 6 or 7 stroke roll. He's laying into these funk things. I'm going, man, that is great. I've never heard that before.
Right. Okay.
And besides just how great he sounded in the grooves and that calm, deep funk that he always does, I'm thinking, oh man. So after that, I heard that. I just had to hear as much more of him as I could. To this day, if I see something, I don't know what it is, but he's on it, I'll just buy it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then there's this thing called Blicker Hammer Gad. These guys are from Norway, I believe.
Right.
And it's Steve and do you know that record? It's an organ and a sax player and Steve. And it's, man, that's a great record. There's two of them now. They just did a second one.
Did you ever go through a period as a player, you know, like a Gadd phase where you were copying like his approach and his stuff?
Well, I would try that. And I realized that I'm not going to ever really be able to conquer that stuff. It was more the approach. I mean, just like I say, the feeling of the playing being very clean and very distinct and very even and that no sense of tension.
Right.
But I still probably can't play the 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover the exact perfect way that everyone has studied. And I've seen it on video many times.
Sure.
That's not so much interesting as it is the innovations that he did. Gadd was something I was never going to be able to own that much.
I'm beginning to realize that the best that you can hope for is to be inspired by his approach and his sensibility and his dedication to the music and hopefully bring your own thing out of it.
But like little things like Samba's playing with brushes, you know, with the snares, but the snares are off. Little things that he does.
Right.
And I've done that, you know, just with the hi-hat on 2 and 4. And I've done that on some gigs. And he says, man, that sounds great. Is that some of that Gadd stuff?
Right.
I said, well, I guess. I mean, I'm just hoping it's just seeping into my life. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I mean, people know I'm a big Gadd fan, and they know about the photograph. That photograph has gotten a lot of play, which is great.
Yeah.
And I just gave it to them as some sort of return for all that he's given me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Steve sort of knows who I am. I mean, I don't see him very often.
Yeah.
I have to remind them, but he knows. And
yeah.
Him and his wife, Carol, she picked a lot of photographs, and I think she picked that one and has been sort of a champion of that. And with the guy who does their website, Malcolm Moore, he's another great guy, drummer.
Right.
He does all the website and all his internet and Facebook stuff. And Michelle Ito does all the tour management for the Steve Gadd Band. And they were recently in Europe, and they used that picture on a backstage pass. And she sent me one. She said, yeah, I'll send you mine. You know, and they're just really nice people. I don't even know what they know, how much I do in terms of playing drums, but I don't really care. It's fine. You know, I mean, it's worth it.
Sure. So apart from the Bonnie Raitt album, is there like a favorite performance of his that stands out as a favorite?
Well, I mean, they all stand out, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know.
Right, pick what's a your favorite. I know.
And who's your favorite child? You know what I mean?
I know.
It's like, I'll tell you, the new Steve Gadd Band album, I must say, I've been wearing that out.
Okay.
I listened to a lot of that. And the New York LA Dream Band, I listened to for years.
Nice.
And then, of course, I just dug around to see whatever I could.
What else know, he was
as
on?
Much as I could. And I still do that. There's a new Gadd record, and he doesn't disappoint. He's very busy. And he has four of his own band. Those four of the Steve Gadd Band are great.
Right.
And they tour with James Taylor. You know, it's the band with James Taylor. So the last, I don't know, five or six James Taylor albums, he's all over that. And it's the same band.
Right.
There's so much. He's so prolific. It's great.
I had the great opportunity to speak to one of my primary teachers and mentors. I really wanted someone to fill in the gaps with regard to Eastman and Rochester and to sort of bring it around from an academic standpoint and an educational standpoint. So this is my conversation with Justin DeChocho.
There's a lot of musicians, I guess, living in that area up in Rochester, not just in the Eastman School, but also just living up in that area.
Well, there's a whole, what they like to call, or I like to call anyway, the upstate burn, which is Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo.
Okay.
There's so many great jazz musicians that came out of that area or that live in that area that it's just ridiculous. And the level of playing of those of the players I'm talking about, it's just, you know, it's like monumental. And unless you're from that area, you don't know those people, or unless they went out, you know, and built careers for themselves somewhere else, you know. But
how do you account for that? Is it just a pleasant area to live in, or are these guys from there? Do they settle there? How do you account for that?
Well, I don't know why that happened, but
okay.
What's interesting, the majority, and I would say like 99% of those players, are all Italian.
Right.
And I always said maybe it had something to do with the tarantella. You know, the tarantella, you know, like 6-8, it's like jazz is like, it's that kind of feeling, you know, that da 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 da. It's like jazz, you know.
Okay.
So I don't know. I'm just, and also there's a thing about, you know, they were all like from middle class and lower middle class families, struggling Italian families. Their parents or grandparents generally came from Italy, you know, and that kind of European Italian mentality and trying to work hard ethic, and
right.
Music is very important in those families.
So there's a cultural component, there's a social component,
yes.
And there's also a sort of work
yes.
ethic attached to it as well.
Exactly. I think so. You know, as I said, I always call it the upstate burn.
Right, right. A lot of these musicians are not household names, but
yes, right.
When you bring them up to other musicians, they're like, oh, that cat's the, you're never going to hear a better tenor player than that guy.
Yeah, well, look at Don Menza. You know, I mean, he's as good as any player playing today, better than most.
Right.
Yeah, and Joe Romano, Jerry Nywood.
Yeah.
So many great saxophone
got
players.
It. So now, Jim said that you were at the concert that the Chuck Mangione Alive album was recorded from.
Yeah. I mean, I've known Steve. You know, I go back years. I knew Steve when he was 14 years old.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I know Steve since 1959. He was from Rochester, and I was from Buffalo. I was in a summer music program in Rochester, the suburbs of Rochester.
Okay.
And John Beck was teaching percussion there. John liked me and took me under his wing, and he said, you should come to Eastman. I said, well, I've been thinking about going to school. At that time, John had just got out of the Marine Band, and he was teaching in the preparatory division at the Eastman School of Music. Steve Gadd was in high school studying in the preparatory division. I was going to say pre-college, but in those years they call it the preparatory division. Anyway, I auditioned in September, beginning of September, and I entered the Eastman School of Music. Steve was like he was one of the hot high school kids. It's almost 60 years I've known him.
Wow. Yeah.
One of my oldest friends. If you think for 1959, I think he was 14 years old then. And at that time, he played like Louis Belson, and he was like into that bag.
Because this is pre-rock and roll, pre-Beatles, British Invasion.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet,
Right.
Before jazz players didn't want to have anything to do with rock. You know, if you were a player, you didn't listen to that shit.
Got it. Okay.
So it was that kind of attitude, you know.
So was there something about his playing then that struck you as being
unique? he was a real natural player.
Got it.
Real natural player, really talented, had great chops.
Yeah.
And we used to play the Wilcoxon solos together because I played all the Wilcoxon stuff before I went. My teacher in Buffalo taught me all those Wilcoxon, you know, Wilcoxon swing solos.
No, what, Wilcoxon?
Oh, yeah, you don't know about that. So, okay,
I don't.
You gotta know.
Okay.
Okay, the Charlie Wilcoxon swing solo. Did we ever do that stuff at LaGuardia Music and Arts?
It's not ringing a bell.
Charlie Wilcoxon was a famous drum teacher and author in Cleveland, Ohio. You should know about
him,
you know. And the Bible, so to speak, of jazz drumming today, one of the Bibles, if you want, is the Charlie Wilcoxon, Wilcoxon.
Got it.
The book is called Swing Solos.
Okay.
It's all the stuff that Max Roach and Philly Joe Jones, Art Blakey, and all those early bebop drummers, it's all the language that they used.
Right.
Is the Wilcoxon. The Wilcoxon book turns out to be all the rudimental study solos, but with a swing approach to them.
Right.
I had studied all that stuff with my teacher in Buffalo before I went to Eastman.
Okay.
And at that time, there were very few drum set books. The Jim Chapin method was out, but there were very few, if any, books on like soloing, how to build drum solos.
Right.
So, as far as I know, at least from the upstate burn, you know, from my area where I came from, I was like one of the first, if not the first cat, to take all those solos and put them on the drum set.
Okay.
And, Steve and I used to play them together on the snare drum next to each other. We play them at the same time together. And then we would talk about it. We're talking about 60 years ago almost. So I'm not sure if I showed him how to do that or someone else did or whatever. But anyway, or he just figured it out for himself. So Steve, at that point, that's when he started breaking away kind of like from the swing kind of thing. Started listening to Max Roach and Philly Joe Jones and Art Blakey, Elvin Jones, and a little bit of Tony Williams.
Sure.
You know. So Steve got to be more and more of that bag. Now he graduates from high school, goes to the Manhattan School of Music for 1 year. Doesn't like it. He transfers, goes back to Eastman, goes back to Rochester, and works out all this stuff in Rochester, and he starts to become Steve Gadd.
So then he becomes Steve Gadd. What do you mean by that?
So he starts working with Chuck Mangione, and this is before Chuck is like the big time. You know?
Right.
Chuck and other guys starts developing and becoming, and that's when he becomes starts to become Steve Gadd.
So we're talking like late 60s, early 70s now.
I'm talking about mid-60s, late-60s, yes, early-70s.
And there's a lot of crosstalk between, like, the rock scene and the jazz scene and the fusion.
Starting to happen. The fusion thing is starting to happen, yes.
Right. Now let me ask you this, and be honest with me. How much of this, because you said early on, jazz players really didn't want anything to do with that stuff. What was the change? Like, by the time we're getting into the mid to late 60s, was there something about this music that made jazz musicians want to embrace those rhythms and those sounds and that and those instruments? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I think by that time, by the 70s that we're talking about, you know, to answer your question about I think what happened was, pop music started to become more and more the rock scene. You know, the Beatles really changed everything. The Beatles changed every aspect of life, not only music, but how you deal with life, how you dress. It overtook everything. They changed the world. The only other person I know ever changed the world that I ever heard of was Jesus Christ. You know, it's like Jesus and the Beatles. You know?
Okay.
So jazz musicians were no longer working. I mean, there was no jazz gigs at all. Now the younger guys coming up, the old guys kind of still, you know, they play their club dates and, you know, whatever jazz gigs they could continue doing. The studio scene started to change. You know, the studio musicians in New York and in L.A. were all jazz players originally.
Right.
They would play in the studios during the day, you know, making all kinds of money.
Sure.
And then at night they would play their jazz gigs.
Right.
Well, the studio scene started to change and more singers were bringing in their own musicians, you know, becoming their own bands, their own musicians.
Right, self-contained bands.
As the younger players, like younger jazz musicians, let's say, you know, came on the scene because they came up through rock. You know, rock and soul and R&B.
And maybe had to go backwards a little bit to get to the jazz stuff. They had to go
If they wanted to do that.
Sure, okay.
Now, Steve, he graduates from Eastman. He's getting drafted in the war, in the Vietnam War.
Oh, okay.
So, me, I'm playing with the Marine Band in Washington. I was the drummer at the White House. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard you talk about that, and I wasn't sure what the details were on that. So you were in the Marines?
I was in the Marine Band, yes.
Okay.
But it was attached to the White House. The band's called the President's Own. And the Marine Band is not only like a concert band, and then there's a marching component to it, but they also, there was a dance, what they called a dance band in those days, and small combos and a string chamber orchestra that would play for all the parties at the White House.
Got it.
Now, I was the official drummer of that. So I was the drummer in the dance band, you know, in the string chamber ensemble and then the jazz combo.
Interesting.
Now, the reason why I got to tell you that is because Steve Gadd now is getting drafted. And as little as you do, he's been playing in Rochester, playing with Chuck and Chick Corea a little bit and some other cats, starting to build a reputation. So he comes to Washington auditions for my job because I'm leaving. My time was up.
That was a way to enlist without enlisting.
You enlist, but each service has a specialized band. The Marine Band, which is the President's Band. Then there's a Army Specialized Band, Air Force, a Navy Band. All those bands, you don't have to fight. You just go to Washington, you become the number one band, so to speak.
Got it.
And you fulfill your military obligation by doing that.
Got it. Okay.
And now Steve wanted to do the same thing, and he knew I was leaving. So he came down and auditioned.
And he got the gig, right?
Exactly. Except in my band, you had to play other things, too. Not only the dance band, so to speak, the big band, if you will.
Right.
But when they wanted you playing the concert band and that kind of thing. So coincidentally, at the same time, the Army Field Band, they have a jazz band. In other words, the jazz band there just plays jazz. They don't do anything else.
Okay.
So Steve auditioned for the Army Band and got the job in the big band. He decided to go there because it was the same amount of time. It was 4 years you had to do.
Yeah.
But all he had to do was play jazz.
Okay, know. Okay.
So anyway, Steve took that job in the Army Band. So he started getting his chops. He was really playing well at that time. So now he gets that all together and decides to move to New York. He back and forth. He wanted to come to New York.
Right.
So he goes back to Rochester and starts playing with Chuck Mangione. Now Chuck Mangione is all of a sudden getting really big now.
Right.
You know, Chuck started that orchestra stuff, you know, with what the hell was it?
Land of
Make-Believe. Yeah, Land of Make-Believe, exactly,
right.
And those things. And so Steve starts meeting all these other musicians, starts building his reputation.
Right.
So Steve decides, you know, his reputation is building really well, so decides I want to come to New York, because that's where the big studio scene is with the jazz cats. That's where Steve really became Steve Gadd. And he took, basically, this is what he did. He took this Wilcox and Swing solos, and he took all those figures, all those solos, he put accents on different sound sources, like he would play it on the hi-hat or play it on a crash cymbal. In other words, he moved those accents and drums sounds around, but playing them, instead of playing with a swing feel, he played them with that even eighth note, 16th note, rock, R&B, wiggly, blues-drenched.
Got
gospel.
It. Okay.
You know, and that's when he developed his style.
Right.
And then from there on, you know everything.
Got
because
it.
By that point, everybody and their brother wanted to, and they call him Steve God.
You know,
everybody in the world wanted him on the record.
I mean, I remember telling us a story about how he was on a session and the producer, he kind of walked in having never heard the music before. And the producer just hands him the chart, and he, like, glances at the chart for, like, a half a second, going, okay, and throws the chart down on the floor, and it says, okay, let's take one, and, like, in the first take, bang, nails it absolutely
exactly.
Perfectly. What fascinates me about him is his ability to take in the entire
picture
right.
of the music. Playing all the stuff he does that is very creative. But I love the fact that he plays for the song.
Right.
And he's got like a macro view of the music and can visualize the song from beginning to end. Where does that come from?
Well, that's the musicianship. Well, first of all, as I said, he had really, great natural talent.
Yeah.
And then he was schooled too. He studied. He has this great natural talent and vision to be able just to feel things, observe. He can almost smell, like he looks at a part. The drum part smells. He knows what it is, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
He just, musicality. He has a sense of musicality or orchestration. And that's how his drumming is, too. You know, like all the soloing and all that stuff. I mean, there are cats that can, as you said, can play all over the drum set. But Steve was the first guy that orchestrated those drum parts in such a manner that it was like a solo percussion piece on a groove, on a time.
Right.
You know, didn't run over the time. He put that all into the time.
Yeah, you can isolate any of his drum tracks and find a lot of stuff to dig into, but hearing those parts in the context of the music, it makes everything fit.
As I said, not only is he a natural player, but he's a studied player in the sense like he played like classical snare drum and he had a great sense or has a great sense of orchestration. Maybe that's your answer.
Yeah.
He has a great sense of natural orchestration plus studied, you know, in addition to a studied approach.
Yeah.
So he had both. He has both. He has the street smarts and the school smarts.
It seems like some of the most successful musicians have that balance of both.
Yes. A lot of times, you know, people have the other thing. You know, they have the school, the study thing, and so on. Play great. And they don't have the street thing. Or a lot of cats have the street thing, but they don't have the other thing.
Right.
But Steve has it both. He has the street thing with all the soul, you know, of all the funk, of all the grief, all the blues-drenched blues and gospel and churchy and funk. But then he also has the school smarts, so, you know, from understanding orchestration, you know.
Right, all that really deep study. Do you have a favorite performance of his, live or recorded?
Well, I liked all the stuff he did with Chick Corea.
Okay.
To me, the quartet album with Michael Brecker, Steve, Chick, and Eddie Gomez.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To me, that's my favorite recording. But as I said, just because it shows everything you're talking about.
Yeah.
Not only is he playing a deep time feel and deep groove, but he's also orchestrating the percussion like it's a multiple percussion solo.
Right.
It's like a string quartet, you know, except it's a jazz quartet.
Right.
But it's all written out. You know, there must have been pages and pages of this stuff.
Right. I got to check that out for sure.
You hear it. You're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, it's unbelievable.
Okay.
Unbelievable. I mean, everybody's playing on that record.
Got it.
But Steve is just amazing because it's beyond just playing a beat or a groove, you know, like you would do, which was second to none. But this is like, I mean, it has all that plus all the other shit like you're talking about. You know, and it's not just drum solos. Well, that's the other thing. A lot of cats like play drum solos for the sake of drum solos. But his soloing is always orchestrated. It's always musical. But it still has that funky, loose, blues-drenched kind of feeling to it.
Yeah.
The quartet album I'm telling you about, you'll see. Okay. Get the original because they recorded it a couple times. Make sure it's the original.
Got it. Okay, I'm just going to say this out loud and get it out of the way. Bucket list for me, I want to get a chance to play with Steve Gadd at least once, either in the studio or on stage.
Well, I got to meet him once, and he was about as nice as could be.
Really?
Ray and Sapp and Warren Oates and the whole New York contingent of drummers. I was the outworlder at this at this drum table.
The outworlder.
And we went to see Gadd with Ronnie Cuber.
Okay.
And Joey DeFrancesco. And,
wow.
And
what
Ray
year is
introduced,
this
was probably about 5 years ago.
Okay.
4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And he was really superbly nice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And again, you know, like we've talked about before, if you go to these guys and you're not fanboy.
Yeah.
They're going to be more into meeting you and talking to
you. Yes. We're running out of time here, so we're just going to start dropping.
How about honorable mention?
Honorable. Let's go honorable mention.
Honorable mention late in the evening.
the entire Wine Light album.
Yep.
Grover Washington Jr.
Then again, there's all the countless stuff that he's not even credited on. Jingles, movie dates.
Honorable mention to a departed colleague of ours, Steve Shane.
Yes.
You know, my wife has a very specific connection to the Breakin' Away album, listening to the cassette in Steve Shane's car.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Steve and I were in a rhythm section together for many, many years in a band that he was leading. And talk about a guy who really absorbed the GAD concept, not just in terms of licks and phraseology and things like that, but thinking as a complete musician and as an orchestrator.
Without a doubt.
You know what I mean? Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree.
Sharing the rhythm section
agree.
With that
and,
guy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would also agree that he had a lot of responsibilities being a band leader.
Being a band leader is, you bring up an interesting point. I mean, it's a fortunate.
Other priorities. Being the band leader and owner of a very successful function band for private parties.
Yeah.
He may be thinking about something else while he's playing. And yeah. You as a musician, as did Gad, as did Kaliuta, as did Dave Katzenberg, as does Will Lee, you assess the situation and you make it work instantly.
That's right.
Nobody else needing to know about it.
Thank you. So I implore all of you listening to take your hard-earned money and start snapping up some of these recordings that we're talking about here.
Right. Google Steve Gadd and buy anything he's on.
And that's the only way to end this thing.
Sounds good to me.
Jeff and I want to thank all of our guests, Jim Saporito, Steve Murphy, Steve Singer, Ray Marchica, and Justin DiCiocio, for sharing their insight on this very special episode. And extra special thanks to Steve Gadd for decades of tremendous music and inspiration. Go to drstevegadd.com to keep up with this iconic musician who's still going strong today. That's drstevegadd.com. If you like this podcast, you'll really love Culture Sonar. It's a place where folks like us gather to discuss and learn more about the music, films, books, and events we love. Plus, you can find lots of cool stuff at our store, shop.culturesonar.com, like the hugely entertaining and educational Deconstructing the Beatles film series. Right now, you can save 10% on everything in the store by using the discount code BREAKINGITDOWN. When you shop with us, you help to support the 60 or so writers, producers, and editors that make this all happen. So visit shop.culturesonar.com and check it out.